It's my pleasure once again to introduce Dr. Mark Shapiro. He's the head of Judaic Studies at the University of Scranton. Mark Shapiro is really, besides being a world-renowned scholar, has been a tremendous friend to Torah in Motion. He's been speaking for us for years and in many ways embodies the kinds of things that we want to do in his own work. His first published book was Between the Yeshiva World and Modern Orthodoxy, the scholarly biography of the Sri Da'esh, Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg. He followed that up with The Limits of Orthodox Theology, a discussion of the Yud Gimel Ikarim, which we talked about at length this morning. He's published a little, very creative monograph on Saul Lieberman and is working hard on a book called Maimonides and His Interpreters. And this afternoon, he's going to address the issue of the lies of Gedolim and the truths of history. Won't you welcome Dr. Mark Shapiro?
Thank you very much. And I just say it's been a great pleasure the whole weekend. And I'm going to speak about the lies of Gedolim. I will say, though, since Dr. Sperber is here, he gave the same title talk last week, but I sat in and it was completely different. I have to apologize ahead of time. I read from notes, unlike you, and you're going to hear the same thing a second time. But I think for everyone else, it's new. I was asked to speak about the tension between historical descriptions of Gedolim, great sages, and the attitude of reverence that we want people to have. You know, that's what we teach them. We want them to have reverence towards Gedolim. What sort of fallout is there when the Gadol is humanized? That is, when we get a real historical portrayal in all of its aspects, does the Gadol's reputation, is it hurt by this or is it helped? And if it's hurt, is this something that we should be concerned with or we should just write history and let the chips fall where they may? Now, this is a fairly new sort of question, as biographies of Gedolim only began about 30 years ago. Since then, we've seen a plethora of books, hagiographies about Gedolim, published in English by Artscroll and others, and in Hebrew as well. And even academic researchers, myself included, make use of these hagiographies because you have to use them very carefully. They have a lot of good and valuable historical information. Obviously, they're not going to have things that might reflect negatively on the Gadol. They're full of unbelievable pictures as well, if you know what's going on in the last 20 years. In fact, there's a rabbi in England, in Gateshead, named Rabbi Falk, and he has a big, thick book on Tznius. And in there, he discusses the problems. You have all these new books about Gedolim in Eastern Europe, and they're showing pictures, and the women are not dressed the way that his book says they have to be dressed. So it's an undermining, in a sense, also. But these are all hagiographies. And why they call them hagiographies? They're lives of the saints. They're written with an agenda, a conscious agenda, not a subconscious agenda. The job of the art scroll, the hagiography, is to create idealized portraits to glorify the sage of whom they're discussing. Now, in the last 20 years or so, we've also seen a number of academic biographies of great sages. And this is where I come in. It's no accident that I was asked to speak on this topic. But for those who are unaware of my writing, let me give you a bit of background, which I think will illuminate the larger question involved here. I came to a graduate school in the late 1980s to write a dissertation in the Department of Medieval Studies, really, on a 20th century figure, Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, known as the Sri Da'esh. As I discovered in my research, there were many people who were still alive who were his students. And this was good and bad. It was good because I was able to go speak to them, to interview them. Many of them gave me letters. I have a large collection, about 600 private letters from Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg. In fact, just a few weeks ago, someone gave me two other letters of his that I wrote to Bialik. So it's a continuing thing. So in that sense, it's very good. The downside of writing about a figure who had so recently passed away, I went to graduate school in 1989, and he had passed away in 1966. So there are still many students of his still alive. The last student, or the one who I believe to be the last student, passed away a few weeks ago, if any of you from Brookline, Rabbi Wolgemuth. I believe he is the last surviving musmach of the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary and the last surviving holder of smicha from Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg. But when I began in 1989, there was about 25 of these people around the world, and I tried to speak to all of them. The downside, and by the way, if I start writing this now, there are many things. First of all, most of the collections of letters that I used are lost now, gone forever. I have copies. But after these people died, the children threw them out. I've been contacted by other people saying, you know, we must have thrown them out by mistake. Can you send me copies? There is a downside, though, in writing about someone who had so many students alive. Because there were many people interested in securing his reputation the way they wanted it. Rabbi Weinberg had many students who, after they left Germany, Torim Derech Eretz land, they became more Haredi. And although they knew what their teacher was like, they thought that certain aspects of his personality were not suitable for today. That is, Torim Derech Eretz is a German thing. But today, if he was alive today, in the state of Israel, he would think that Torah only is the way to go, and they didn't want different aspects of his personality investigated. Let me say, though, at the outset, that this was not all of them. I received much help from figures in the Haredi world. I'll give you some names. Rabbi Gifter, for example, tells Rosh Yeshiva. He was very helpful, gave me letters. Rabbi Rakov, the late Rabbi Rakov, the Haredi, very Haredi Rav of Gateshead, was very helpful. He gave me letters. One of the members of the Soloveitchik family in Jerusalem. Now, this is not the Soloveitchik family in America. This is an not just anti-Zionist, they're anti-Aguda. They're like the Troy Carta, the most extreme right-wing Orthodox you can imagine in Jerusalem. And yet, they were very welcoming to me because Rabbi Weinberg was very friendly with Rabbi Soloveitchik from Zurich, from that side of the family, the Velvel Brisker's side, and they were also very helpful. So it's not just a question of right wing or not, but there were many in the Haredi world who were very hesitant, and even though I said things like, if all I'm getting are the letters from the more liberal, the Torim Derech Eretz, this will prevent a false picture. I need to also see the letters to the yeshiva world to balance it, and some appreciated that, but others didn't. And I have a note right at the beginning of my book saying that there were certain collections of letters which I wasn't given access to and why I don't think it'll change the overall picture. But that was what I had to deal with. Getting back to the story. Among the collections of letters is a very large one addressed to a professor, Samuel Atlas. Atlas, who passed away about 30 years ago, was a former yeshiva student, Sabotka and elsewhere. He became very close to Weinberg in Berlin. He then comes to America and joins the faculty of the Hebrew Union College. He never was what we would call a Reform Jew, but he wasn't Orthodox. And he was involved with the Reform movement, a very big Talmud Chacham, the standard edition of the Raivad and Baba Kama, the Parish of Raivad, which is found in all the yeshivas in Toronto, was edited with the notes of Shmuel Atlas and Weinberg. One person who knew who Shmuel Atlas was the famous Rav Menashe Klein, and he has a tshuva. Can you use Atlas's edition? And not surprisingly, he says it's usher. You can't. Well, you can use it. You have to cut out all the notes, but you cannot use the edition of Shmuel Atlas. But no one else. He also has a tshuva that says you can't use Jastrow. I mean, but he knows who these people were. The average person doesn't know, but Atlas was a great Talmud Chacham. And Weinberg was very friendly with him. Weinberg was friendly with him from their youth. And in a sense, he was Weinberg's alter ego. Weinberg was able to speak to him in a much more open way than he could speak to other Orthodox figures, certainly than Gedolim. Weinberg also wasn't married. So all he was divorced. All the problems he had in his life that he would tell his wife, he told to his closest friend. His closest friend, Shmuel Atlas. And I had heard about how they were... that they were very close, and there's a couple of responsa in the Sridi Yesh Atlas. So what did I do? This was 1990. I called up, I looked in the phone book, and lo and behold, his wife was still alive in New York, Mrs. Samuel Atlas, who just passed away a couple of years ago. I called her up, and I said, you know, I told her my project, and she told me some stories, because she used to go with her husband during his summers to Switzerland. I told her about what I'm doing, and asked her, where are the letters? And she says, yes, I have many, many letters. And they are all at the Jewish Theological Seminary. We gave them there because they knew Professor Lieberman. They gave them to the seminary. But she says they're in a restricted collection. No one can see them till after I pass. Well, yes, why? I'm assuming she thought that they had personal things about her or the family in it. And they did have some personal things. Nothing of a bad nature. For example, Atlas writes to Weinberg about it. They want to adopt. They didn't have children, so they wanted to adopt an orphan from the Holocaust. But she didn't know Hebrew, and she thought maybe there were personal comments. And so, and this is not uncommon. People give correspondence or archives to libraries and say not to be seen for 25 years or 50 years. It's pretty common. Well, I went to the seminary, and I'm going to tell you about something I did, which is bad now. But I'm not going to apologize for it for the simple reason that sometimes you feel you need to do these sorts of things. I was in Jerusalem about 10 years ago when I uncovered a vast trove of letters, full of letters. It was letters from Soloveitchik, another rabbanim there, and I'd go. Every time I went to Jerusalem, I'd go in the basement. It was behind all these boxes in the closet. No one knew about it. No one cared. And I'd read the letters. And once I took out letters to the widow of a great rabbi because I thought maybe she'd want to have them. But I kept saying to myself, you know, no one cares. No one, it belonged to a certain yeshiva. Let me just take them. I could do something with them. But I couldn't because that's Geneva. And yet I come back last winter, first time I was in Israel in a number of years, go down to the basement. They had completely redone it. There's a nursery school there. The box is gone forever. I didn't even take them out to make copies because I felt guilty. In retrospect, had I taken them, had I, quote, stolen them because they were, no one was taking care of them. It was Hefkeiros, it would have been a lot better. But I didn't do anything like this. The story I did is I went to the seminary, and where they're kept, and they're not in any, I thought maybe I could see them, even though they're in restricted collection. That's what we scholars do. We try to get in. They're not listed in any of the folders or anything. I couldn't find them, but she told me they're there. The librarian didn't know. This is upstairs, the fifth floor. So he calls Professor Schmelzer, who's the librarian of the seminary, who was at that time, I guess, was semi-retired because he was home. And he told them where the letters were. He didn't say you can't see them. He said, yes, the letters are kept in this place. She goes in, or he goes in, he brings them out, and he puts it in front of me. Now, this is the, you can condemn me ethically later. I open it up, and right on the first page, it says, this is a restricted collection, not to be examined without the approval of the librarian. And I reasoned the librarian, Professor Schmelzer, just gave me approval. Although I, truthfully, there was a date on it from about 15 years before. I doubt that Professor Schmelzer remembered even. Be that as it may, I read the letters, and after reading them, and I saw how important they were, I called her up that night, and I told her that I read the letters, and she wasn't that upset. She says, but they were not supposed to be. I said, yes, but they were just there. I read them. And then I convinced her. I told her how important they were to me, and I asked her, would she give me permission, because I couldn't make copies of them. Obviously, if I to make copies, they'd see the big taped-in letter there saying you can't. And after explaining what I'm going to do and that there was nothing, you know, embarrassing, she agreed to that I would have permission, just me, no one else. Now she passed away. Anyone can go see them, which became significant in a few minutes, as you'll see. Because I wasn't able to make copies of these letters to anyone, including the controversy that developed. But she gave me permission to use the letters, and copies were made and sent to me. Now, what was so important about these letters? It was an incredible find. It is the only example, I believe, in history of where we have, well, Rav Yaakov Emden is a different one, perhaps, because he wrote an autobiography. This is Professor Breuer mentioned this after reading my dissertation. But it's the only example we have, other than Yaakov Emden, where we have the innermost thoughts of a Gadol B'Yisrael, a recognized sage, writing to a close friend who is no longer in the Orthodox world, expressing his deepest thoughts and feelings and frustration and anger and hopes and fears. And to write a biography, to use this material, I mean, this is incredible. I had already been rebuffed years before, 2 or 3 years before that, when I was told that someone in Eretz Yisrael had letters when Rav Yaakov Weinberg was a youth. And he was on, thinking of, to use a phrase, say, going off the derech. And he didn't know, should he stay in the yeshiva world? Should he go to Haskalah? I write about this. He had an Elter Bacher, Rav Shechtel Neuberger was his name, father-in-law of Rav Yaakov Ruderman. And he wrote to him, and they gave me the letters in Torah. But there were two letters they said they couldn't give me. They asked a child because they said it's voyeuristic. I even offered just not to quote them in the book, just to go up to read them, because, you know, you want to see it. These were his inner letters, which he's writing, and they wouldn't let me. And I tried a couple of years ago again. They still wouldn't let me. Obviously, this, to me, from the standpoint of the biography, it's very important. We think it's important. Another example, just to show you how our minds work differently. When Rabbi Weinberg died in 1966, someone came into the house and took out lots of stuff. Among those things was a picture of Weinberg from the concentration camp he was in. He was actually a prisoner of war camp. He's sitting in his prison uniform with all these Russian officers. Now, if you read my book, I described the whole prison thing. There's no picture. Why is there no? It would be a great picture. Because the person who has it says it's degrading for a Gadol B'Yisrael to be shown without a yarmulke, to be in a prison uniform, you know, and this, it's degrading. He has to be seen in rabbinic regalia. I don't see anything degrading about a Jew. It's nothing degrading to the Jew being put in this situation. This is part of the life. This is part of history. But you see, this is a very different vision, a very different vision. So I published a selection of these letters in 1997 in a journal. It comes out at Yeshiva University. It's called the Torah Mata Journal. It's a huge, it used to be at least, huge distribution. They printed 5,000 copies. Every student got it. They sent it to all. Every alumnus was sent this. And there was a selection of letters. I did, as rabbinic journals often do, I took out names of individuals. I just left in the his ideology, his ideas, how he expresses himself. And I'm in Scranton, far away from any real Jewish life. Certainly if you're in New York, you don't consider this as real Gaulis. I don't know what's going on. I get a call one afternoon from J.J. Schachter, the editor of the journal, and he says, the Jewish world is going crazy. This is 97. Again, the Jewish world is New York Jewish world. That's the Jewish world. People are outraged at the publication of these letters, or at least some people. He said, not all. Some are, the people who thought they were great were the ones who were calling me and emailing me, but he says people are outraged. And not only that, I have been accused of forging these letters. And, of course, I am supposed to send copies of all the letters to J.J. Schachter. Here's a problem, which, I violated. I'm not allowed to. You're not allowed to send copies. I wasn't given permission. But in this case, I'm being accused of forgery. I made an exception. I sent him copies of letters. Not all of them, but just to the ones, the really controversial ones. What was the problem? Why was there such an outcry? Why was I accused of forgery? Because it was stated by people who knew Rabbi Weinberg that a Gadol B'Yisrael could never write these things, the sorts of things we'll speak about in a minute. It was impossible. A Gadol, like we spoke about on Shabbos, for those who are there, the Tosfos could never say this. So the Bach says, we have to amend the text. A Gadol B'Yisrael could never say these things. And those who knew him better and knew that he had these feelings, they said, even though he said it, it never should have been publicized. And this was then followed by a great debate, two issues worth of letters. Professor Sperber contributed a letter on the propriety of publishing these letters. And in general, my book was published soon afterwards, and it led to great debate on how to write biographies of Gadolim. And in almost every review of my book, there was, 25 reviews, it's always compared to Art Scroll, as if the anti-Art Scroll. And that's what it became. And the great fear of many was that Weinberg's reputation would be hurt. He would be removed from the canon of Gedolim. Unlike Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg is in the canon of the yeshiva world for reasons we can't get into now, even though he was much more liberal than Rabbi Soloveitchik on halachic matters. He's in the canon. Every year on his yahrzeit, they publish Miyatei Neman about him. The fear was this would cause him to be removed from the canon. It hasn't happened. But on the other hand, for many, reading the letters and the biography gave them a great appreciation of the sage, for they see him as a human, imperfect figure like we all are, struggling with the sorts of things that we all struggle with. And the biography, I'm very proud of this, actually made him a household name in the modern Orthodox world. Before that, he was known as a posek with some interesting ideas. But there's really been an explosion of interest in the last 15 years. He's a towering figure. And it's just because people are attracted to his life story, with its pain and its tragedy. Of course, this was not my goal. My goal was to write history. Let the chips fall where they may. And by way of illustration, let me tell the following story. Before my book was published, and then before I published a Hebrew collection of Weinberg's writings, all sorts of people approached me with advice on that. One person even said that when I write the biography, and I quote all these letters, at least don't say it was written to Atlas. that he was friendly with a reform type. One person came to me, someone in the yeshiva world, and he said he has a problem with me publishing in the Hebrew volume Weinberg's essay on Herzl. Weinberg wrote a beautiful essay on Herzl called Ish Hadat, in which he portrays Herzl as a Baal Tshuva, one coming closer to Judaism. Just hasn't reached the whole way, but coming closer. The problem is that today it doesn't work in the yeshiva world. Herzl is regarded as Avi Avot HaTumah. He represents secular Zionism, and therefore to publish this would hurt his reputation in the yeshiva world. And he said to me that I, as a modern Orthodox person, he couldn't convince me for his own reasons to censor it, it should be important to me that Weinberg, a liberal gadol, is still in the yeshiva world's pantheon, because that provides all sorts of liberalizing possibilities in the extremely, in constantly more and more right-wing world. And that if I would have published this, and he's thrown out of the pantheon, this will just add more steam to the rightward shift of the Haredi movement. And as long as he's still in there, this provides, at least as he said, I should have understand some sensibility still in that world. And that's a reason that I should have for not doing anything to hurt his reputation in that world. He thought I wouldn't censor matters for his reason, but here he's showing me, I guess he thinks that everyone censors, a reason why it's in my interest to do that. And my reply to him, which I don't know if he understood, What is that of the modern Orthodox Jew? I indeed regard it as important that Weinberg is in the canon of the yeshiva world. Halavai that Rav Soloveitchik was also in their canon. But while that's important to me, I said historical truth is more important, and therefore I'm going to publish his essay on Herzl, which he himself published twice in Hebrew, including once in the 50s in Sha'arim, which is a Pola Aguda newspaper, and once in English, and he wrote about it in his private letters. And if as a result of this he becomes persona non grata in the increasingly extreme Haredi world, so be it. I should note that it never happened. In fact, a book came out last year called Atchaltahi by the Merkaz Arab Circle, and they excerpt this whole essay into a long chapter. It's devoted to different gedolim and their views on religious Zionism, people you wouldn't expect, including Rav Yoshev from his earlier years. And they include this, and this is a major part. So it's had an influence. I said to him, and I say to you, it's not my job as a historian to make all sorts of calculations about the person I'm studying, to begin with a set agenda, and then go about trying to create a story that will reach the conclusion I've already come to at the beginning. If Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg on his deathbed had become a satmar chassid and disavowed everything he believed in his entire life, I would have written that also. And if not, I need to find a different profession. Let me now return to the issue with which I began. Are the critics correct, though? And are realistic portrayals damaging to our feelings of reverence to great Torah sages, of knowing the truth of their lives, of their life story, of the disputes they had? Gedolim had terrible disputes one with the other. In Day of Adibor, which is Yated Ne'eman's online newspaper, the following appeared. Quote, if you go on it, at the bottom, it says, why the title of the article is Why We Censor, and in parentheses it says, Our Most Popular Ever. Quote, a related complaint is that we leave out information. That is true, but the reason is that in our Torah space scale of values, the harm or embarrassment that can be caused to someone, perhaps a family member, a bystander, rates much higher than the needs of the historical record or journalistic objectivity. Of course, the problem is that the family member might be embarrassed that their relative or parent attended YU, Yeshiva College, as with Rav Shimon Eider, who recently passed away. Nothing in the obituaries that he ever attended BTA or Yeshiva College. Or Rav Yitzchak Shiner, who was the only one of the Gdolim who could read English, and who therefore was the one who declared that when they gave it to him that Slifkin's books are all kafira. He's the only one of them that read it. Rosh Yeshiva Kamenetz. He's from Yeshiva College. Or that Rav Wachtfogel from Lakewood, the Mashkiach of Lakewood, he's no longer alive. Yeshiva College, Chavrusa with Shmuel Belkin. He taught Belkin English and Belkin taught him Gemara. The family member might also be embarrassed that the patriarch, whoever it is, was very close to Rav Kook. Last year, a new edition of the very important Sefer Enayim LeMishpat was issued by Rav Yitzhak Arieli. It's a number of Masechtas. Missing from the introduction, they cut out from Rav Arieli's own introduction, is his discussions of Rav Kook and Merkaz HaRav. He was Rosh Yeshiva there for something like 40 years. One of Rav Kook's closest Talmidim. But today, in the world they're living in, because not all the Rebbeim in Merkaz HaRav, they weren't like Gush Emunim, Tzihuda type. They were Rosh Yeshiva, who are more open-minded, but they still, their children, their grandchildren, they still live in a Haredi world. Pasnish today to see they want the Sefer accepted, so you take it out. Thus, we get to the point that history can be censored no matter what the reason. Or just as important, the bystander might be harmed from this perspective. How so? The bystander could see that this Gadol was a religious Zionist or had sympathetic feelings to Zionism. And since today we know in that world that Zionism is completely unkosher and we don't want people to chas v'shalom be led in that direction, therefore it's vital to cut out any information that reveals that he had a religious Zionist perspective or maybe he thought that Erevin were a good thing or any number of things can be censored. Now the issue really came to the fore with the publication of Nussan Kamenetsky's book, Making of a Gadol. And in this book, I'm sure you all know it, he hasn't yet been to Toronto, but I know there's always plans to bring him. In this book, he provided a realistic portrayal of Gedolim, and from someone who grew up with a father who's a Gadol, who knew these Gedolim from up close, and he provides a realistic portrayal of Gedolim. And he justifies this in the introduction. He says that there are two ways history has been written about in the Orthodox community, the hagiographic approach and the realistic approach. And he tells us that he is going to write real history. and he's a Rosh Yeshiva. You know. While portraying Gedolim as the outstanding figures that they were, he tells us that if, quote, if a minor blemish, and on a truly great man it is never more than minor, also exists, it does not ruin the grace of the outstanding personality. He's going to provide a realistic portrayal. And we all know that the response to him was severe. His books were banned. He was even put in Cheirim personally. It's incredible. And if he even has another book, which hasn't yet been published. He asked me, should he publish it? I said, if he values his sanity, don't. But he'll give it to anyone who goes to see him. It's called Anatomy of a Ban. Making of a Ban or Anatomy of a Ban, I forget. The original book is Making of a Gadol. And he gave it to the Hebrew University to be seen in 25 years. And it used to be that he would only give it to special people. Now apparently he gives it to everyone. And he tells the story with documentation. He styles himself as a historian. Pictures of all the bans, the cheirims. And it is a very revealing reading. But the conclusion we must draw this episode is that the Haredi leadership is not interested in real history, but rather with inspiring tales. After all, they will argue, what Torah value does history serve? They will say that we look to the past, and Rabbi Schwab has a famous essay on this, we look to the past in order to provide inspiration, not to know the details of disputes and people's personalities. Why do we need to know about the disputes between this Rav and that Rav? Now, it's possible that history does serve many important purposes, but they don't believe so. And I will say that the Rambam agreed with them. The Rambam writes, isn't it how history is a waste of time? It's interesting, however, that there wasn't any great criticism in the Catholic world with the publication of the letters of Mother Teresa. Remember a few months ago? In these letters, written to her spiritual advisors over many years, we see that she had very dark times where she doubted God's presence. She wanted these letters to be burnt. But not only were they not burnt, they were published. The church figures who had them and the church hierarchy believed that despite her wish, it was too important for these letters not to be published. They see these letters as the part of the heroic struggle to come to terms during crises of faith, during times that everyone goes through when you don't feel in touch with God. And they thought that this is an incredible lesson. People can see how even a saint goes through times of religious crisis. And that she still had the strength to continue on with her good works, knowing that she felt God's presence in the past. She hopes she'll feel God's presence in the future. She didn't decide to close up in Calcutta and go to France to become a socialite. She continued, and the most important thing is not what she was feeling inside the times that she lost her faith, but the good works that continued. And that's the real barometer of a life lived close to God, how you live it. And I think that the church's picture on Mother Teresa is a very realistic picture and can give strength to people who are not saints. Yet I know that these letters would never be published in our world. At least they would try to prevent them. And a great sage who is shown to have had periods of doubts, as Mother Teresa had, would no longer be regarded as a great sage. On the contrary, he would be regarded as an apikoros, as a kofar, all the things. I have no doubt of that. And there presumably were letters like that, but they will never be taken out. The Catholic Gedolim, if we can use that word, are portrayed in a much more realistic manner where their humanity and all of its complexity is allowed to be seen. Rav Lichtenstein writes in one of his essays, in discussing what we can learn from non-Jewish writers, that we have nothing in our literature that approaches Augustine's Confessions. Now, he doesn't get into the reasons why, but I just alluded to them a minute ago. Returning to Kamenetsky, his response to his critics was quite interesting because he made the following point, which is fascinating. He was accused of being disrespectful to the Gedolim by portraying them in a realistic fashion. And according to the Haredi leadership, only an idealized portrait is okay. Kamenetsky shot back that it's actually his critics who are degrading the honor of Gedolim. They don't honor the Gedolim. Now, how can he say that? After all, they're the ones who are constantly producing books that are from page one to the end are idealized portraits of these Gedolim. How can he say that it's his opponents who are the ones who are really disrespecting Gedolim? Kamenetsky reasons as follows. Take Gadol X, for example, Rabbi John. The truth is that this Gadol had a bad temper. This was a flaw. I think we can all agree that having a temper is a flaw. Yet he was still a great man. And Kamenetsky will write about how he was a great man, everything he did, but also discuss the fact that he had a bad temper. The Haredim feel that the only way he will be regarded as a gadol is if they cover up this fact, that he has no faults. So they are disrespecting the Gadol, because they assume that someone without a temper, someone with a temper cannot be a Gadol. This Gadol X actually had a temper, so in their minds he's really not a Gadol because he has a temper, but they need to portray him that way for political reasons, so they cover it up. So they're really not portraying Gadol X, they're portraying the Gadol that they've contrived, because if they really portrayed him as he is, well, they could never portray him because he wouldn't be a Gadol. So Kamenetsky says that I respect the Gadolim where they are. You don't respect the Gadolim. You don't even think they're worthy of people knowing anything about them. So because you present them as frauds, as people take a certain Gadol, for example, was a Zionist. Kamenetsky says we have to say and explain it all. But since you believe, he says to the Haredim, and he's from that world, that if you're a Zionist, you can't be a Gadol. Because you have to be a Gadol if you're a Zionist. Therefore, we have to portray this Gadol not being a Zionist. But the fact of the matter is, he says, you really don't think he's a Gadol. Because if you thought he's a Gadol, then you couldn't say that you know more than him. You think you don't really respect Gadolim. You respect these contrivances that you've created to further your own objectives. That was Kamenetsky's point, and he made it quite forcefully. And if you're interested, you can even hear him online making it. He spoke at the Young Israel Borough Park a number of years ago. You can hear that, and he explains this in great detail. It is an ingenious approach, no question about it, but it is incorrect. Kamenetsky's incorrect. The thing to remember about Haredi society, and this has very much been the theme of this entire Shabbos and Sunday, is that Haredi society operates on many levels. The intellectuals, the ones who are the censors, are more sophisticated than the masses. Yatei Nim on the newspaper has a committee of censors. They determine what goes in and what doesn't. They know all the truths. They know, the censors, that there were Gadolim who had faults or who were Zionists. Of course they know. They live with them. We even have people in this room who grew up with Gadolim, so they can testify. Everyone knows that. But they're not in the business, they say, of pointing these things out. They are using biography as a form of hashkafa training. And that's why they censor and don't describe Gadol X as having a temper or being a Zionist. They know that a Gadol could be a Zionist. But for hashkafa training, for influencing, it's dangerous today for the masses to know that. Therefore, they take it upon themselves. So it's not like Kamenetsky says that they might be disrespecting Gadolim and that they think they know more, but their attitude is actually, if Gadol X was alive today, he would agree with us. And today's day and age, look what Tzionus has caused, we have to do it differently. So obviously, there's going to be a tension between the academic approach and the Haredi understanding. However, at times, it's not at all clear that, quote, humanizing a Gadol is negative. It can actually be a benefit to the Gadol's reputation and the religious feelings of many people. And for a good example of this, let's return to the letters I published of Rabbi Chilak of Weinberg, which really, why do people oppose this publication? Well, for the very reasons people oppose publication were the same reasons other people supported publication. Some saw it demeaning, Rabbi Weinberg, and others saw it as a very positive thing. What was the first thing? How could you have letters of a Gadol written to someone who identifies now with the Reform, he's at a Reform institution, he's not an Orthodox Jew, it shows Weinberg close to such a person? That is degrading, to show that a Gadol Bistrol had such a relationship. Chas v'shalom. People should not know that. And I couldn't even have written my book without these letters, because these are so important, the way he speaks to him. Yet this information, that Weinberg, despite ideological differences, still remained on close personal terms with someone who was no longer in the Orthodox world, would be viewed very positively by people with a different frame of mind. They would show how he was not closed-minded, how he was able to be respectful to people, even though they were not in his world anymore, how he could still cherish a friendship from his youth, even if the person had chosen a vastly different form of life. So the very same reason why some people saw this as a pogrom, l'gnai, as a negative thing, other people saw it l'shvach, as a positive thing. And they put Weinberg in the same category as Samuel Belkin, who was very close to Reform Rabbi William Brody, or the Rav of Soloveitchik, who was very close to conservative Rabbi Joseph Shubo in Boston. And they see this as a positive thing. Or Rabbi, I mentioned Rabbi Leiter of Pittsburgh, who was actually quite close to Rabbi Freehoff, a leading Reform halachist. Freehoff thanks Leiter in the introduction to a number of his books, at least one in particular, I know. So this is you see, for the very reason you could be against it, you could be for it. There was also concern because of what the letters said, and that a couple of the letters, two in particular, expressed disappointment with some aspects of Jewish law, in particular Jewish law regarding Gentiles. Romberg was troubled with this. It bothered him. And he writes about this. And for some, this was unacceptable. To have a great rabbi, to have problems with aspects of Jewish law, you know, they have to have like a muna tamima, muna pshuta, this was unacceptable. Yet once again, it's precisely this that many people would see so significant, where Weinberg shows his humanity in acknowledging that certain halachot trouble him. He's bothered by them. He doesn't throw the law out. He doesn't say, like we said last night, about conscience, get rid of it. He acknowledges it's a problem, and he's sharing the difficulty he has with it and trying to find a solution, eventually settling on the Meiri solution. So for the very same reason people said it's a bad thing to publish it, it portrays him as someone who doesn't show emunah, other people see it as on the contrary. Listen to what David Berger wrote about this very issue and why he regards it as so important that we have an insight into a Gadol's mind in this matter. Quote, "It's for this reason that I welcome the controversial publication of Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg's letters expressing his distress over some of these texts, that is, text laws dealing with Gentiles. That very distress is Torah, the Lilmon Anu Tzrichim, and we need to learn from it. Rabbi Weinberg has taught us that we are indeed permitted to agonize over these questions, and we are not defying God's will by so doing. And it is not, as a Talmud Chacham once told me about a related matter, prikat ol, throwing off the yoke. And what I published also had a halachic significance, in that we see that Weinberg adopted the view of Meiri with regard to how we relate to Gentiles, and then follows in Rav Cook's line, Rav Deutzi Hoffman, and many others. He's another important authority arguing that the Meiri's approach is the approach, the only approach suitable for modern Jews. And I spoke to someone I respect very much, Professor Lyman, and when I spoke to him about this, he said that comments of a substantive nature like this, not personal attacks against someone, substantive natures are divrei gedolim. We cannot censor the words of gedolim on issues such as this. And many others said the same thing. The dispute over how to portray gedolim, I'll just briefly now in a few more words before concluding, it's not just a modern concern. I mean, as I said, biographies of gedolim really just took off in the last 30 years, although we have some from before then. It really goes back, it's a piece of the dispute, how to portray biblical figures, which has been a burning issue in the religious Zionist world as well recently. Rav Aaron Cutler famously, he wrote an essay, How to Teach Torah, where any description of flaws or faults of patriarchs or other biblical figures is completely off limits. And Hirsch, also famously following in the Ramban and Abarbanel and others, believes that we can look at the biblical figures and perhaps there's elements there, like when Abraham, when he allows Pharaoh to take Sarah, things like that. We can discuss it because Hirsch says that the Torah is teaching us realistic portrayals. And if the patriarchs were, obviously they're great tzaddikim, but if they were completely perfect and fallible beings, there's nothing for us to relate to in that. And this dispute goes back to Chazal. We have Chazal who portray biblical figures in a very unrealistic way. If they portray them either completely wicked or completely righteous, and that's not how they appear in the Bible. Think of Esau. Esau, if you read the Torah, he doesn't seem so bad. You know, what does he do so bad? He's, as I said, once he's maybe out, you know, taking rabbits and ripping their heads off and the things like that. Maybe his wives are not to his parents' liking. But in Chazal, he becomes the personification of evil. Evil. He even becomes Edom, Rome, which is the worst of all evils for the sages of Second Temple. The same with Bilam. Bilam becomes the personification of evil. In the Midrashic description of Bilam, he becomes the one who does every possible sin imaginable, including having sexual relations with his donkey, who lays down with him at night. In fact, when you read the stories, the Midrashim, about Bilam, you're no longer reading about the historical figure of Bilam, you're reading about the archetype of evil. And the Maritz Chayas, in his introduction to Talmud, discusses this very point, how Chazal rework figures to turn them totally evil for purposes of pedagogy. Then not to say that this is the actual figure of Bilam. By the same token, figures are drawn great, even though from the Torah itself, they're portrayed, or the Tanakh, they're portrayed in a much more sketchy manner. Think of how the sin, which is condemned by the Bible, the sin of David with Bathsheba and Reuben's actions with Bila, think of how they're justified in the Midrash, to which Abarbanel is very upset. He's very upset with these Midrashim because he can't get rid of what the Chumash says and what the Tanakh said. But that's a characteristic of Midrash. Well, this would lead you to think that Chazal had Rav Aaron Kohler's approach. That even when it looks bad, make it look good, or say that even though it's condemned as a sin, it's only a tiny sin, and if we did it, it would be a mitzvah. But when they did it, they were on such a high level, it's a sin. But Rav Moshe Tzuriel, who's a mashkiach in Israel, some of you might know him, I used to be a shalavim for many years, he points out that we find plenty of examples where Chazal do the other way as well. Moed Katan, it mentions how, it doesn't say this anywhere in Nach, that for 1 year, the Jews, during Solomon's year, including Solomon, didn't observe Yom Kippur. I mean, what is that saying about them? They derive that midrashically. Similarly, the midrash speaks about how Abraham was to blame for Yishmael developing. It doesn't say that. It speaks about how Eli and his sons and Yitzchak and Esav and David and the problems with his sons. It goes so far as to say that Moshe gave one of his sons to be raised by Jethro in a pagan environment. I mean, can you imagine? So Rav Tzuriel places these two traditions, what they call a realistic portrayal, where you derive certain things only positive, I mean, only the way you see it, wherever the chips may land, or the hagiographic approach. Rav Tzuriel traces this in an essay all the way to Chazal, down to her own time, and the Netziv. Incidentally, the Netziv goes on the Hirshian side of this. And I have no doubt, incidentally, that if you asked Rav Aaron Kohler, he would say, fine, Chazal can say that. We can't say that. And I'm not saying that anyone in this room should say that. I find it very distasteful when sometimes I hear modern Orthodox rabbis, they say things like, in front of the crowd, Devar Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu was a failure! You know, trying to get everyone's attention. And then, of course, they explain, you know, the people never listen to him, they're always rebelling against him, but it's a way of speaking, and I personally don't find it respectful, but you can see that there is a difference between, learning to try to, at least in a respectful way, maybe point out, maybe Yaakov, he favored, one of his children, and that led to the problems. I mean, this is the sort of thing you could see that in the Torah world, there'll be two different approaches to this. So let's return to the issue of biography and the tension between historical truth and reverence. I do not deny for 1 minute that the tension exists, and I have no doubt that some people will be hurt by seeing the realistic picture which I attempted to draw. This is not something that should be treated lightly. Rav Kook says that even if something is true, I've said this I think 3 times on this weekend, even if something is true, that doesn't mean that everyone needs to know it. You don't go in, Slifkin doesn't go into Meir Shearim and tell them about what he spoke today. They never heard of Darwin. And Rav Kook says this, even if it's true. He says it in Orot HaKodesh. So I understand that. Yet I would also say, and as I pointed out, for many, humanizing a Gadol can actually be a benefit for his reputation. How so, you ask? I think that today, intellectually sophisticated people are not moved by hagiography. People who read real biographies by Doris Kearns Goodwin and all the rest of them about Franklin Roosevelt and John Adams, they're not moved. They can't be expected to read hagiographies. They need to read serious works. Why should Torah literature be any less significant than secular literature? It has to be on the same level. And seeing the true life story of a Gadol who struggles, that can provide inspiration. And in fact, many people I know, because they've written to me, have found themselves moved by the story of Rechiyach of Weinberg. But let me also say something else. I never set out to write, quote, orthodox history. I'm not an orthodox historian. Yaakov Katz made the same point about himself. And indeed, he writes in his autobiography, there's no such thing as orthodox history. What do I mean by that? Because when you begin to write it, you don't have a conclusion. You don't know where it's going to end up. It might not end up the way you want it to end up. Orthodox history, artful history, the conclusion is known before it begins. Well, we know that's not academic. That's not how we define history in the academic world. That's a different type. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's a different genre. It turns out, in fact, that's the way history was done for thousands of years. It's only in recent times, the last couple hundred years, that we have history, a more of an objective academic. How did Josephus write history? He wrote history with an agenda. How did the Greeks, when they wanted to portray the death of Alexander? I mean, history was never of independent value. It was always written with an agenda. So I'm not saying they're wrong. They're wrong if they portray themselves as real historians. But it has its purpose. I try to do real history, so there can never be orthodox history. It so happens that many in the orthodox world like the book I wrote, other things. I'm fortunate I get paid to come to speak, and I enjoy it. But I never intended it to be this way. I always intended to write real history, and it's actually been a very pleasant surprise to me that Jews all over the country, all over the world even, took to this and are interested, and it's almost like a thirst that Orthodox Jews want, and not just modern Orthodox Jews, Haredim, Dayanim, the two Dayanim in London based and wrote me about this, people in Brisk, and I was, it's sophisticated people. It's not a modern Orthodox versus a non-modern Orthodox. The difference is that in the Haredi world, I find it's only the sophisticated ones who can appreciate real biography, whereas in the modern Orthodox world, since that's what we're all brought up in, hagiography doesn't speak to a lot of people. You don't need to be, quote, the sophisticated, but this is what we relate to, all of us. So in the modern world, I would say to us, and really conclude with this, those who are sophisticated in their general lives, it's a real problem. How can you expect them to be satisfied with hagiography? They will not. And I actually think that's a good thing for the fact that they might come away with negative feelings about certain rabbis, seeing that these rabbis were involved in disputes and the like. Why are we supposed to assume that that's such a bad thing? Maybe it's a good thing. We're not like the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church tells their parishioners who your priest is, who your bishop is. Our gedolim, we choose them. We choose our rabbanim. Every shul chooses it. We choose our gedolim. We ask them the questions, and that makes them into the gedolim. If there is a certain great rabbinic figure, and it turns out he has a terrible flaw of sorts, isn't this the sort of thing, if it's the sort of flaw that we need, that people, there are certain minor things, but of a certain flaw, this is the sort of thing I think people would need to know. Because if you, buyer beware, you know, if you're going to make a certain person your rav, your posta, he's supposed to be domo l'malach Hashem, if he was involved in all sorts of financial shenanigans, defrauding the government, the sorts of things that Professor Sperber mentioned last night, I think this is important to know. When a rav comes to town and he's going to paskin shilas, it's important to know that he got out of Allenwood prison a couple of years ago for defrauding the government. I mean, these are the things people need to know to make an educated choice. Informed decision. And I've written about this sort of thing. I've never written about it in my books, but I have written about it on the blog. Some of you read, I know, is the Sfarim blog, where I wrote about a certain Gadol, one of the leading halachic authorities in Germany, who happened to be a forger. And he forged a work of a major Rishon. And I think it's important for Torah Jews to know that this work is a forgery, and that the person who forged, he's a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He's obviously a schizophrenic personality. He still could be a tzaddik, but he is an unreliable person. What he published is unreliable, and we need to know. These are the sorts of, and for all the cries of Kavod HaTorah, Kavod HaTorah, I reply, Kavod HaTorah means also that forged works written in the name of Rishonim cannot be passed off as authentic Torah text. That also is Kavod HaTorah. But this doesn't mean that we don't be concerned with Kavod HaTorah and Lashon Hara. We do need to be concerned with it. And I actually think that in this area, Kamenetsky actually went too far. He, as not being a trained historian, he doesn't know how to draw out facts from a wide variety to make his case. His book is quite voyeuristic. And there are certain things about one Gadol in particular, Avraham Cutler, where I totally understand why the Haredim banned it. I mean, from their perspective, what he wrote is really terrible. From their perspective, I don't believe in bands. It is voyeuristic. It does not contribute to any greater portrait. And it's the sort of thing that I don't believe I've ever engaged in, because I do think we need to have a balance. And yet there are issues that will be very hard to tread. And in those issues, my attitude is, if I don't feel I can do it honestly, I don't go near it. I can't write a biography of Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg and not discuss his private writings, his letters about Zionism. Because then when I discuss his views of Zionism, I'm being dishonest, I'm being inauthentic, because I'm leaving out things. But I do have the rights to say, because this is problematic, I don't know where it's going to lead to, I don't know the repercussions, I will choose not to write on that. I don't need to write on everything. There's a great Rosh Yeshiva who had an incident of a hijacking, and there's all sorts of stories about this. He hasn't had a hagiography about it because this is going to be a very problematic thing to write about, because there are many people who have very negative feelings about this, and you can't skip over this. So this is the sort of thing, made for myself, I wouldn't write about it. But to write a biography and not discuss these things, that is fraudulent, because you have to, if you're writing a biography, you need to discuss the complete picture. So in summation, and there's nothing wrong with this either, libraries embargo thing for 75 years. Maybe we can write about this hijacking incident in another 75 years when no one's alive. I mean, there are times, not everything needs to be done at the moment. So in summation, let me therefore conclude that real history is not for everyone. It's certainly not something we need to teach our little children, but there certainly is a place for it. And in the more modern communities, serious portrayals are, I believe, requirements for people with modern secular educations, and I don't even think it's an intellectual requirement. I think it's an ideological and indeed a spiritual requirement to give people in the more modern communities powerful writings about Gedolim that they can relate to, not just hagiography. So thank you. And if we have time, I think maybe for some questions.
We have a few minutes for questions, if there are any. And if there aren't.
Over here.
Sorry.
Right. Again, from what you said, there seems to be a lot of tolerance towards hagiographies, or maybe I might call them revisionist type of historical accounts. Unfortunately, these types of revisionist accounts, they lead to conflict, they lead to misunderstandings, they lead to disagreements. And I ask why we should be as tolerant as you seem to indicate we should be. Just one point. I mean, just taking it to a very, very large extreme, you can argue that the Palestinians have written revisionist history of the Middle East, and they've come to their conclusions as a result, and they've done a good job of convincing large parts of the world population of it. We don't feel we should to be tolerant of that history. Why should we be tolerant of this type
good
of revisionist
question.
History?
And we also, Israel also has a revisionist history, a history of their own national myth. I mean, the idea that no Arabs were ever pushed out of the area around the airport in Lod, and that they all left on their own, and that they're going to come back when the land is conquered. That was very important to be part of the national myth when Israel was founded. You know, otherwise there'd be pressure. The Jews who had themselves been refugees would demand, how could we have these people as refugees? But now you have people like Benny Morris and others who are showing it's not true, and Israel did drive many out, and Benny Morris's point is that they should have driven them all out, and that was the big problem. Now, so we all have myths, so we can see. Now, as for the other point, look, if you read my blogs, you see I'm a relentless exposer of the fraudulence, of the not just in the Haredi world, in the modern Orthodox world, and other things. It all needs to be exposed. But that doesn't mean that simple people, every simple person needs to be, as Rav Cook said, if they come into our world and if they're trying to make changes and things and affect us with the fraudulent stories, it needs to be exposed. But I don't believe that if they want to live by their Bubba Meisters and this and that, that's a way of life. I'm very much like Slifkin in this regard. Only when it threatens to interfere in the larger community, and for the intellectuals. Anyone can go on the internet, they can read books of me and others, David Asaf, et cetera, think Chabad. The son of the Lubavitcher Rebbe was a Meshumet. Okay, so any Chabadnik who's an intellectual reader, he knows this. Do I need to go to the simple Chabad person there and start telling him this to them? They just can't grasp these sorts of things. I don't believe we need to have universal enlightenment. Universities used to be a place for elites. Everyone else went, some went to the gymnasium, the rest went to technical school. In America, they started this idea, everyone needs to get a university education. I once heard from Professor Tursky, it was a lot better when some people got university education, the rest lived in a different way. What's so bad about that? Okay, yeah. The last question, I guess. One last one.
I've heard people say that one of the reasons not to write biographies was because
Yeah. It's hard to know what Lashon Hara is, truthfully. You don't really know what Lashon Hara is. I mean, I have read many letters of Gedolim. I continue to read and they're full of negative comments about other rabbis, which you would say is Lashon Hara. As anyone know, they badmouth them all the time. But you've asked this Rav, he would say to you, it's not Lashon Hara. Gemara tells us we have to expose the chanafim. What's a chanaf? A hypocrite, a flatterer. We are supposed to expose hypocrisy. So I assume that all these rabbanim who said terrible things about other ones, and we're great Talmidei Chachamim, if you asked them, they would not say it's Lashon Hara. They would say he's a fraud and I need to expose it. It could be that he's not a fraud and this is just a personal machlokes, but it's hard to know what Lashon Hara is. I don't think it's Lashon Hara to talk about a dispute that the whole world knew about, that it was in all the newspapers and it's a fight. And if a certain Rav did a bad thing, I'll tell you this story. There is a Rav. I give this example. There's a Rav. He's not a gadol of the first caliber, but he's a second caliber. You know, many people here would have heard of his name. He had a child out of wedlock when he was young, about 17. He was in yeshiva. About 20 years ago, one of the Israeli newspapers exposed this. They published the adoption certificate and everything. I think that's a terrible breach of privacy in his life. You know, he just made a mistake when he was young. I don't think it's anyone's business. And that I known about, you know, and I never would expose something like that. And if I knew about it, maybe I would choose not to write about him, because how can you write and not talk about this? However, if there was a case like this where he had this child and he then abandoned the girl and he wanted nothing to do with them and he became a big scholar or Talmud Chacham, a postake, and basically he was guilty of such a thing, I don't consider that Lashon Hara. I consider this an example of exposing the hypocrites. So it's very hard to know what Lashon Hara really is. Yeah. Yeah.
They consider that
Now, I don't know. I fully admit that I'm speaking now as a Jew who tries to balance Jewish values and historical values. As a secular historian, you go into the grave and dig up the body if you need to. And they dug up Zachary Taylor's body to see if he was poisoned. It was in the secular world and as a secular historian, I would have no problem as a secular historian if I was writing about a figure like Einstein. But among Gedolei Yisrael, I can honestly say, though, that I never had to make that choice for Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg. I would rather not write about someone if I had to cover something like that up. If Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg had such a situation, I could not write about it because I have to be honest. So I was honest. But I admit, and this is not maybe what you expect from someone, a PhD in history, that I think that certain people do need to be, certain great rabbinic figures, I would treat them differently than other figures. And if that's not in accordance with the historical, you know, so what can they do? Take my tenure away? I don't know. Life is not only about the historical craft. But in the historical field, everything needs to be known.
Yeah.
And one more thing, I just one more final comment. For example, Weinberg. I think everyone was clear from the book that he spoke badly about a lot of people. He had difficulties. That doesn't mean I need to get every single detail of this rabbi. He said this and that. He said that. You know, every biography is about choosing from a mass of information. And I believe I succeeded. And I did not succumb to Gedolim worship. But I also thought I wrote a respectful biography. Thank you.